magic. But once you learn the spells, they become second nature. Most war magi, who aren't masochists, only use them if absolutely necessary. Now seemed like a good time to indulge. I said the appropriate mnemonic trigger words, drawing on every last spark of power left at my command, and suddenly everything around me was in slow motion, as if the combatants and their victims were mired in glass. In fact, it was my perceptions and my reactions that had speeded up. My head hurt from the effect, and my stomach desperately wanted me to throw up what was left of last night's cider. But I didn't take notice of my body anymore, except in passing, when the war magic spell was activated. I was more than mere flesh, for a few glorious seconds. Pain and fatigue became something to note, not something to suffer. But the spell wouldn't last long. I had to take advantage of it. I dropped my staff and sprinted towards the shaman, moving three times faster than I could possibly have hoped to, unaugmented by the spell. Slasher came to my hand automatically, adding the little power stored in the blade to the magical field that fueled my body, and a wordless battle cry erupted from my lips of its own accord. I noticed in passing one of Henia's arrows in flight, hanging in the air like it was taking a leisurely stroll. Few among the foe even noticed me as I raced among them toward the shaman. A Gervan warrior who tried to interpose himself between me and my prey raised his club high over his shoulder. But then Slasher slashed. I left him behind me, clutching the stump of his hand in shocked amazement, while I faced the real threat. The shaman saw me coming, of course. No doubt his own mage sight was up in this chaos, and I would be difficult not to notice. He shifted his beady gaze toward me, even as he prepared to release the spell he had hung, a defiant grimace on his scarred black lips. I guess he thought I was either a knight with some spark of talent, or a hedge mage with a sword, but he definitely did not expect or knew how to contend with a fully trained veteran war mage, or else he would have shifted his spell to a defensive one. They taught us in War College that the all-out offensive attack has a better chance of succeeding than a more cautious approach in such situations, and I was testing that theory with my life. I could feel the power surge from his hand and couldn't help stealing some to keep my own spell going. He seemed lousy with it, and as he jutted one fist at me, the arcane power leapt from one hand to the other. Quickly, tapping into that unguarded stream was easy, particularly because he wasn't, or didn't know how, to defend against the effort. That gave me enough of a jolt to follow through with my attack. When the power rushed over me, I realized too late that it was far more than I'd ever been able to manage. My reserves weren't exactly full, but I felt better than I had since the damn bell had awakened me. Well enough to eliminate this ugly goblin. As I slid to a stop near him, with a twist of my wrist, I sliced at his left knee, right shoulder, left side, and his neck, in rapid succession, while my other hand worked a distracting little flash cantrip to keep him distracted from defending properly. It was a partial success. He blocked the first blow with the haft of his club, and part of the second, as I circled around his body with preternatural speed. He was still trying to block the third in precisely the wrong place when my thin mage blade passed horizontally between his shoulders and his head, severing the neck neatly. He died before he was aware of the fact, and as happy as I was about that, suddenly I was faced with a dilemma. Magical power that is summoned and not used can either dissipate slowly, or it can release explosively, depending upon the vessel and a host of other factors. That was what had killed the mad mage of Faris during the final assault during the war. He had built up power, tremendous power, to counter our attack during our siege. Then Oriel Pratt, half mad in his grief and resistance, had been deprived of his release mechanism at an inopportune moment, and it overloaded his brain. At least that's what the gossip said. But there are important laws in magic, laws which can rarely be violated. All of that power must be expressed somehow, and in the absence of a powerful mind to control it, magical energy can be volatile. When the mad mage finally blew apart against the greatest war magi of the day, he had taken a good portion of the tropical citadel with them. When I realized just how much power the Gervan had summoned, I knew that I was in a similar position. It was also likely to take out me, most of the surviving goblins, all of Sire Cusi's cavalry, and probably half the village, unless I could channel it away somehow. It was happening too quickly for me to form an apis, or other thaumaturgical construct to absorb the power. I had to channel it. I still had the remnants of the fire illusion hanging around, and that seemed to be the most convenient thing to do. So I sent it all into one big fire illusion spell and directed it straight up. The result was spectacular. A fountain of fire nearly a mile high and 12 feet across, bursting at its apex in the biggest firework I had ever seen. It lit up the entire village like it was daylight, and it could be seen for miles around. It was so terrifying to the normally nocturnal Gervani that those who were not already retreating bolted and ran as fast as their hairy little legs could carry them. Me? I collapsed in a heap next to the recently living body of the shaman. I stayed there, catching my breath and waiting for the spell to diminish, until Sire Cusi himself, jingling with every step in his armor and spurs, shook me back to consciousness. "Excellent job, spellmonger," he said, a grin dividing that grey-white mustache and beard, when I regained my senses. "We've got them on the run. My knights are chasing them back to their damn hells. But that would have been difficult going without... whatever it was you did. Well done." I stared up at him for a moment while I tried to make sense of what he said. This seemed to be an occasion that called for a grand and noble gesture. I had just been honored by the Lord of the Domain, after all. It seemed a good place for ceremony, a gesture, or at least a few thankful words. When speech was available to me again, I managed to mumble, "Thank you, my lord," before I bowed and vomited used cider and bile on his boots. Chapter 2. My History and a Frightening Discovery. Once upon a time, in a tiny village called Talri on the bank of the great river Burin, in the Riverlands barony of Varun, the Duchy of Castol, a great and powerful mage was born unto a common man and his wife. I'll spare you the suspense. It was me. The place I grew up was a nice, quiet little river village, where most of the people farmed or fished. A few sold goods and services to those who farmed or fished, and even fewer lived off the taxes paid by those who sold goods and services to those who farmed or fished. It was a pretty little village on the west side of the river, only 6 miles from the looming castle Tari, where Baron Lethar made his home. My father had the baking license for the river village of Talri on Burin, and was viewed as a master of his craft by his colleagues as far away as Dretzel. His bread was always smoother and tastier than any the farm women made, his pies were counted as having no equal, and the fruit and honey cakes he made for holidays were the stuff of legend. He supplied bread not only to most of the village and the barges that travelled the river, but the baron's castellan also sent to him for special dainties that the castle bakery couldn't produce as well as he could. He was particularly good at berry pies, and as a kid, I made a small fortune selling reject pies out of the back of the shop to my peers. In any case, due to my father's incredible ability to take flour, eggs, yeast, milk, and such, and transform them into the best breads in the 5 duchies, he thrived. He married my mother, daughter of the miller in Poom Hamlet, upriver 50 miles or more, got his master's license, secured a grant from Baron Lethar, and began a long lifetime of raising bread and kids in relative prosperity. As his fame and recognition as a baker increased, so did his fortune, until he had the 3rd largest house in town, a small stable of his own, and the exclusive right to make sweet pies and pastries for a 5-mile radius of his shop. He was blessed with a beautiful, hard-working wife and many children. All girls. When my eldest sister was born, my mother says he was as excited as any new father. When my sister Letha was born 2 winters later, he feasted his neighbors on her name day and spoke expectantly of the son his wife was sure to birth next. 6 years and 3 more daughters later, he had become something of a town joke. With each new, pink, healthy daughter my mother presented to him, it added to his despair. Don't misunderstand. He was a doting father to all of his children, loved each of my sisters dearly, and never once griped about their dowries. But he wanted a boy to pass his craft to. He envisioned a dynasty of great bakers. He tried everything to hear my mother tell it. He consulted the Baron's wizard, the local hedge mage, itinerant witches, birth sisters, and every granny within 20 miles, seeking a surefire way to ensure male conception. He went so far as to sponsor a festival in the village to Trig, the mother goddess, ostensibly to celebrate my eldest sister's coming of age, but in reality as a means of begging her priestesses for a boy. After a decade of non-stop procreation, I finally arrived. My father was so happy he could have burst. My mother was just relieved. 6 healthy children is a lot to expect from a woman. Not that she minded the attempts. I get my lusty nature from her. But by the time I came along, she was ready to lapse into the role of grandmother. They named me Minilan, after my maternal great-grandfather, and proceeded to spoil me only as a boy with 5 older sisters could be spoiled. My childhood was cushy, comparatively speaking. My sisters took turns babying me and torturing me, depending on the sister, her mood, and the position of the stars. Mama was strict but benevolent. She had raised 5 spirited daughters, so I didn't get away with much. And Dad tried to be stern, but usually ended up being as indulgent to his only son as he was to his daughters. He did make me work hard, though. Running a bakery is hard work in the best of times, and no hands ever went idle. Father worried initially that the overdose of female attention would soften me. But by the time I was 5, it was clear that I was as sturdy as hardtack, and had the spirit of a spicy pepper roll. Dad relaxed. He had his heir. Until that fateful day. When one of the village men shook me awake the next morning, I had been dreaming about Tolri and my parents. The sun was well on its way toward noon. Tyndall was snoring beside me, almost as tired as I was from an evening's work that had not ended until dawn. It was a mark of how exhausted I was that I had not responded to the wards that should have alerted me to his presence the moment he crossed my threshold.
"Begging your pardon, Master Minilan, but Sire Cusi and Sir Kay would like to see you. They're in Mickett's barn," he said when I finally came downstairs.
With that, the villager, whom I didn't recognize, a thick man wearing a brown woolen cap and tunic that was the unofficial uniform of the Bovali peasants, turned and left. He also wore a thick leather coat over his tunic, and carried a 5-foot spear like it was a hoe, so I assumed everyone was still on alert from the attack. I glanced at my snoring apprentice and decided to let him keep sleeping. There was no reason we should both be falling off our feet. I quietly picked up my weapons belt and tiptoed down the stairs, where I took a moment to put myself in order. I put on my business cloak, a dark blue woolen mantle that I had paid a local lady to embroider with stars and moons and all sorts of meaningless arcane symbols. I also grabbed my hat, the standard 4-pointed affair that had been a fashion rage 300 years ago. It was now the unofficial headgear for professional spellmongers and other magi. 3 of the points were smaller than the last, and were sewn to the conical center. I felt a little silly wearing it, but the more important the man, the sillier the hat, my father always told me. I grabbed my staff from where I had dropped it last night, and decided I was ready to meet the Lord of the Land. I tiredly tripped over the threshold as I left the shop, so I stopped and hung a cantrip that would make me appear alert, awake and refreshed, in utter contradiction to the way I felt. It used nearly every scrap of energy that a few hours of sleep had restored, but I couldn't appear before His Excellency, Sire Cusi, Lord of Beauval Vale and Liege of Brandmont, looking like a wastrel. I was greeted along the way with solemn nods and grateful smiles, and even a bow or two. There was a new respect in the eyes of my neighbors, thanks to my efforts in the attack. Several made a point of thanking me.
"Yea, I'm a hero,"
I thought dully, trying to ignore the wailing cries of those who had lost family in the night, or the moans of the wounded where they suffered from their beds. I saw several men who had fought the previous night, and made a point to nod back to them. They were the ones who deserved the praise. It's easy to take a man who has been trained to fight and put him in danger, It is much harder to rise to the occasion when the toughest fight you had ever been in had ended with a mug of cider and nothing more serious than bruises. The 30-odd victims of the Gurvani had been a severe blow in a hamlet so small, but they carried on as if it was the day after market day. The stoic mettle of the Bovali impressed me. Many of these sturdy mountain people were going about their business as if nothing had happened at all. A knot of men-at-arms in the livery of the Lord of Bovall Vale, a white cow on a green mountain, were loitering around outside, and I nodded sagely to them as I passed. I was surprised when they snapped into a loose approximation of attention. I just didn't warrant that kind of thing. I saluted automatically, and then grinned self-consciously at myself when they returned the courtesy. It had been a while since I had done that. Lord Cussy and his dour castellan, Sir Kay, were inside, puffing away on their pipes while they looked over the stacked bodies of the raiders. There was a nasty, cloying odor of death, blood and burnt hair that was truly nauseating. Live Gurvani smell fairly pungent, and death does little to help matters. I understood immediately why they were smoking so early in the day. I bowed to the gentleman before quickly moving to light my own pipe.
"Master Minilan,"
the Lord of Bovall said around his pipe stem in his high, reedy voice,
"my thanks for your expert work last night. Had you not rallied the people and plied your magics as you did, I would have found Minden's Hall a smoking ruin and been shy several tenants here this morning."
He bowed his silvered head in a gentle salute, revealing the beginnings of a thin patch in the center of his pate. The Lord of the Vale was a short man, but well-muscled, and he had seen at least 50 summers in this valley. He had sharp, penetrating eyes that held equal measures of intelligence, wisdom, and wit. He was also an adept warrior, good with a lance or sword, and an excellent combat leader. When I had first met him during the Farisian campaign, he also proved an excellent drinking companion, in addition to being a competent officer and a fierce fighter. His men, mostly doughty archers and tough country knights, likewise impressed me both in battle and in camp. He had brought 200, mostly peasants, retrained as infantry or archers. He had brought more than half of them back from that hellish province, which is more than many commanders from that bloody campaign can say. When I took him up on his invitation to settle in his remote little valley, I became even more taken with the man as a liege. He proved to be a good overlord in peacetime, as well as being a good war leader. His people didn't quite love him, but they did accord him far more respect when he was out of earshot than most nobles warranted from their subjects. In the 6 months that I had lived here as village spellmonger, I had witnessed him dispensing judgment and making shrewd decisions that convinced me that he had the best interests of his people and his lands in mind, not his own aggrandizement, a rarity among the nobility anywhere. Sir Kay, on the other hand, was a tall, hulking, sulking, bitter-faced man of 30 summers or so, a distant cousin of Cussy's from Gans. Sir Kay was typical of many of the country gentleman knights of the Alshari Wilderlands in most ways, but he had a flair for organization. He was an excellent manager of his lord's estates, despite his famously sour disposition. He hadn't accompanied Sir Cussy to Faris. Someone had to stay home and tell the peasants what to do, I guess, and I could see now why Cussy had been so jovial on campaign. He may have been an excellent castellan, but having Sir Kay around was much like being a teenager under the eye of a matronly and disapproving aunt. "It was my duty and pleasure to serve, my lord," I said, lighting my pipe by flashy cantrip, and then bowing. That sort of thing impresses the layman, you know. "I am only sorry I could not have saved more of your people." Almost 20 of his subjects were dead, and twice that many were egregiously wounded.
"I blame them, not you,"
he grumbled, kicking a black furry corpse with his pointed horseman's boot, causing his spurs to jingle. I winced when I noted that there was still a large, splotchy vomit stain on it.
"Particularly that witch, Doctor. He was quite potent, it seems, to do so much harm so quickly. Though not as tough as our spellmonger."
Cussy laughed, slapping me appreciatively on the back. I didn't think it was that funny. "He was the most powerful mage I have encountered since Faris, my lord," I said seriously. You recall we encountered the Govani in the jungles of Faris? I said. He nodded. He never tired of mentioning the war and the grueling campaign, although he saw it a damn sight more loftily than I recalled. Their shamans were good, but not nearly that good. That shaman was handling far more power than any single mage in the duchies. I cannot tell you where he came by it. Perhaps he was just abrim with talent. But that kind of power would have almost classed him as a master mage. I trailed off as a horrifying thought suddenly occurred to me. Faris. Quickly. Where is his body?
Over there, Sir Kay grunted. The men wanted to start lopping off heads for warning spikes, but I insisted that all bodies be thoroughly examined first.
Probably for loot, though he was too darn noble to say it. Kay likes being thorough, but he's also utterly incorruptible, when anyone is watching.
Excellent,
I muttered absently, and began the unsavory process of hunting through body parts and disemboweled, furry little corpses. I was looking for one particularly gruesome limb. Thankfully, it didn't take me long to find it. I pulled the leathery black fist, severed midway between elbow and wrist, from under a pile of other discarded body parts. The cut was clean and sharp, which meant it was most likely the one I was looking for. The axes of the villagers and the lances of the horsemen made wounds far less neatly than slasher. Carefully, I pried the stiff, cold fingers apart. At the center, as I expected and feared, was a centimeter-wide stone of bright milky green, like an emerald, only far deeper. It was smooth around most of its diameter, but had a rough backside. I exhaled slowly and backed away a step. Saya Kusi and Sir Kay had crowded around me, and when I stepped back they jumped as if bitten by the thing. Then they relaxed when it didn't do anything in particular. Of course, if they knew what it was, they would have headed for the horizon as fast as their feet could carry them. I never wanted to be a wizard. Indeed, the thought had never occurred to me. My plans around adolescence centered on finding some way to get Hedy, the miller's daughter, alone, and up her skirts, and eventually inheriting the shop some day, and baking bread for the rest of my life. Noble goals, these. But fate, or luck, or the gods, had other plans, and about the time I started growing hair in unlikely places and cracking my voice, things just started happening. I began learning the basics of professional-class baking as soon as I could knead dough. I had a perfectly common boyhood for the first 12 years of my life as my father's apprentice. Nothing more extraordinary than fights and stolen kisses ever happened, and if I blackened more eyes than I received, it was probably because I ate too many cookies and was strong from toting too many bags of flour and cutting too much firewood. You might not appreciate just how much firewood a good-sized bakery requires on a daily basis. Dad's ovens were huge. Between the needs of the castle and the village, and the regular contracts for journey bread Dad had with barge captains, he had 2 large ovens that rose above the roof of our house, and 1 small one that was still pretty damn big. They were rooms unto themselves, large enough for a man to crawl into to clean. And guess who got that job? They dominated the rear of our house, great pregnant-looking domes constructed of wicker and river clay. Dad had painted them the traditional red, of course, and you could see them for almost a mile downriver. Every morning he, or one of his apprentices, would get up long before dawn and start the laborious process of feeding the fires, banked the previous day. Every third day, someone, always one of his apprentices, rank hath its privileges, would climb in with a broom and spade and excavate the mounds of ash before they relit the fire and began stacking wood upon it. It took 1/4 cord of wood to reheat the large ones back to baking temperature and 1/2 to keep it going all day. We used a lot of wood. Dad employed 3 families of woodcutters to supply him. I started toting wood from the shed to the ovens as soon as I was old enough to walk. At first, it was fun. Then it was work. Then it was torture. By the time I was 12, I had lugged whole forests of trees into the gaping maws of the ovens. While I didn't know it at the time, my magical talent, or Rijara, as the old Imperials call it, was starting to come out. It was little things at first, things I didn't even notice back then. During hide-and-seek, I could always find everyone, no matter how cleverly hid, or hide myself so well that I'd never be found. While playing ball games, I always knew when and where the ball would be before it got there. Perfectly normal childhood magic, the kind that every kid everywhere thinks that they can do. But in late winter of my 13th year, things came to a head. I'll never forget that day as long as I live. I had spent most of the night fuming about a fight with my youngest sister. Ura and I had always been at odds, largely because we were closest in age. In truth, she was no better or worse than my other sisters when it came to alternately teasing and spoiling me. But Ura had a temper, and she often took it out on me when she was fed up at being the youngest girl but not the youngest child. We fought often, over stupid things, and sometimes it escalated beyond reasonable sibling rivalry, and came to blows and nasty tricks. I don't remember what the particular offence was, but I do recall that she got away with something big, and blamed me for it. As a result, Dad had given me punishment detail for 3 weeks. In our house there was only one punishment. Feed the ovens. That particular day I had gotten up way too early, gulped the cup of hot milk, and stomped out into the late fall chill to begin my torture. I fumed at Ura the entire time. I stomped my way back and forth between the shed and the ovens, a journey that I had long ago calculated to be 23 steps both ways, and on each trip back I held almost as much wood as I could carry. Every step of the way I cursed Ura under my breath. Not a good idea in front of the oven, which is also a shrine to Brigga, the fire goddess. In Bovol they call her Brina, other places Briga, but in Tolri she was Brigga. But I was pissed off at my sister and figured the goddess would understand. By trip 6, it took 9 trips for enough wood to get the fires started. The exercise had warmed me up. By trip 8, I had loosened my jacket, and my boyish curses had become audible. At the end of trip 9, I stacked wood as if every piece was aimed at my sister's head. I had worked myself into such a frenzy that I didn't even realize that I had started a fire. With magic. I stood and gaped in horror as the dry poplar and oak sputtered into flame. In moments, a roaring fire was making my face uncomfortably hot. Smoke poured out of the oven's mouth, as it normally did. The fire was spreading evenly from place to place. It was a perfectly laid fire, but I knew for a fact that I hadn't started it. The spill I would have used was inside the house on the hearth altar yet. Had Brigga heard me, I wondered, horrified that I might have just doomed my sister to a premature and fiery death. I dropped the rest of my wood and started to run away, when I ran smack into my father's rotund belly. I looked up at him with tears in my eyes, and he looked down at me, concerned. "I saw the whole thing," he said softly. "Get your cloak on and go out to the shed, to my workroom. There are some things you and I need to discuss." I nodded, and then remembered my chores.
"What about the oven?"
"I'll get Ura to do it. She should be up by now anyway. She'll never catch a man if she stays lazy like that." I grinned at him, relieved that he wasn't angry at me. I grabbed my heavy wool cloak and trudged outside to the woodshed. When you think woodshed, you probably think of a tiny shack, just big enough to store a half a cord or so. Perhaps if we were a simple farmstead. My dad burned so much wood that he required a huge shelter for it. The entire right side of it was full of firewood, while the left side held my dad's workbench and tools, as well as a few extra bags of flour and salt and such. Behind that was Dad's workroom. Mama may have run the house and shop like a duchess, but the shed was my dad's domain, a place of refuge from his wife and family when he craved solitude. I was almost as shocked by the invitation as I had been by the magical fire. Dad's workroom was forbidden territory, inviolate, his inner sanctum. It was where Dad kept his records and did his accounts. My father was proud of his literacy and secretive about his money. I found out later that he kept his secret recipe book there too, the one he claimed didn't exist, in a brick-lined safe under the floor. Mama never even went in there. To be caught anywhere near it was grounds for a switching, An invitation within had never been extended to any of my kin that I knew of. I waited outside until Dad showed up, not able to bring myself to enter alone. He didn't speak, just laid a fire in the tiny stove and poured water into a small tin kettle on top. Two mugs were set out, and I could smell the crushed kaffir leaf in their bottoms.
"Well, son," he finally began in his deep baritone, "it looks like you broke the egg basket on this one."
"Dad, I don't know what..."
"What happened?"
"I think I do, but I'll need a little help to explain it." And with that he reached up on the top shelf and took down a small, pint-sized earthenware jar. I knew about that jar. Just about every kid's dad in the village had one of those jars, stashed somewhere where their wives wouldn't find it. It contained a very powerful distilled liquor that Opa the woodcutter made to supplement his meager income. Regular spirits were available to the folk of Tawdry, but they were taxed heavily. While Opa's brew was untaxed and therefore illicit, I don't think the Baron or anyone else minded his discreet trade. Opa brought a new pint every week when he made his regular delivery. Sometimes when Dad had friends over, he'd take them out back to show them something in the shop, and they almost always seemed friendlier when they returned. He pulled the cork and took a deep sip, then handed it to me. I was in shock. This meant I was a man, by the unsophisticated standards of village artisans, and I swallowed repeatedly before I could bring myself to take a drink of the liquid fire. I coughed and sputtered, but Dad expected this and was ready with a cup of water. When I had calmed down and warmed up significantly, he had me tell him everything I could about the event. When I was done, he took the jar back and stood up, sighing. I sat there silently and watched him putter around, looking behind books and under papers for his pipe and herb pouch. I found watching him comforting. He seemed so calm, and the shock of the earlier event was starting to fade into a dreamlike unreality. Armed with pipe and pouch, he sat back in his chair and began the ritual of packing it. He also began telling me about my family, on my mother's side. Mama's people were from Poom Hamlet, 20 miles upriver and inland another 6. But they weren't from the Castali Riverlands originally. They had relocated there about 5 generations back, from someplace up north, around the Colleen Mountains. Family history said that they were nobility. Legend said royalty, from some long-forgotten petty kingdom in Wenshire, on the outskirts of the Majocracy. The name Manuforthan was somehow attached to the legend, though if that was the name of an ancestor or the name of the kingdom, no one was sure. What was whispered, though, was that our ancestors had been mage lords, potent magi, who had left the borders of the imperial lands in the east to strike out on their own, away from the power of the Archmage. When the Narasi tribes that were my father's ancestors swept down from the steppes on the decadent imperial lands, Mama's ancestors had fled south. Some of them fled to Poom Hamlet, where they settled down, forgot about magic, and ran the mill. Dad had never thought anything might come of it. All of Mama's kin seemed normal enough, except my Uncle Clo. But that's just the way he is, having intermarried with Narasi over the generations until there was no trace of their imperial past in their features. No one else seemed to show any signs of magic in their blood, but the possibility was always there, Dad explained. It had always been there, but he and Mama hadn't taken it seriously. Until now.
"What in 6 hells is it, Spellmonger?" Sire Kusi demanded at my gape-faced stare. "It must be magical and deadly. You look as though you've seen a ghost."
We were among the pile of bodies the surviving peasants had gathered for disposal, with their dead kin and neighbours arrayed respectfully on one side of the barn, the black and furry foes piled up unceremoniously on the other. As soon as it was light enough to do so, I had tracked down the corpse of the shaman, and then spent more time seeking his shattered hand among the stiffening limbs of dead Gervani. The little black fingers still clutched it tightly in the rigor of death, but I had pried them open and revealed his treasure.
"Not far from it, my lord,"
I answered, breathlessly, my heart sinking a foot a minute.
"That, sire, is something I haven't seen since the Phrygian campaign. It is something that most wizards live a lifetime and never get to see.
The one I saw there was half this size, and in the hand of a master sorcerer.
Is it an enchantment, then?
He asked, having no real idea what he was asking. I answered him as he wanted.
It is all enchantments, my lord,
I whispered, and it means trouble for your domain. And my livelihood, but that wasn't what I was focused on. I had bigger things to concern me than my clients. Indeed, my worst possible fear was realized. The Imperials called it Irionite. My people, the Narasi, called them witch stones. It's a type of green amber, found, it is said, in some mountain streams in the Kulines and Mindens. But this innocuous-looking little translucent rock was mightier than the foundations of the strongest fortress. It made a dent in my mind, like a magical fire whose flames warmed the part of me that does magic. These stones were once only nearly mythical devices. Now they were almost unheard of. Historically, they were extremely important. Witch stones were the source of power that propped up the ancient and creaking magocracy for centuries against the onslaught of my barbarian ancestors after all. And for centuries, it took little more than that. Irionite magnifies a mage's natural expression of magic a thousandfold or more, providing an abundant font of arcane energy to those attuned to them. No one knows how or why. The few specimens that have popped up have presented an irresistible lure to the magi who found them, and all study on the matter is a closely held and highly regulated secret under the bans on magic. But the barest amount of that translucent green stone was enough to amplify the powers of the dullest mage. A simple flame cantrip, such as I use to light my pipe, can be turned into a raging inferno with a witch stone. Spells that would ordinarily take hours of preparation and concentration could be done with little effort. Or so I had learned. Wars had been fought over the stuff. A lot of them. And recently. The mad mage of Faris had killed thousands of soldiers and sailors from the duchies with a mere sliver of it. To see that green pebble in a black and furry hand made me so frightened my bowels turned to water.
This is going to complicate things,
I said in a voice that was almost a whisper. For those of you who weren't fortunate enough to get an imperial education in the art and science of magic, and I assume that is most of you, the story of Irionite is intrinsically intertwined with the history of the magocracy, and, by extension, that of the five duchies, and of all Kalador itself. The magocracy evolved on the lost island of Perwyn, a mountainous subcontinent located somewhere in the Eastern Ocean. It was alleged to be the birthplace of man, though there are other places that claim to have human settlements at least as old, and most legends say we were spawned from the void above. But when we arrived, we knew little of magic. The tree folk taught us. The first archmage, Cordan, legend has it, united the various tribal magi of Perwyn under his banner at the city of Nomawi, and fighting against the original despotic rulers there. While he was consolidating political power, he also established in writing the basic principles of magic, convened the first Privy Council of Magi, and founded the first Imperial Academy of Magic. He also fought a successful war against his competitors, using his cabal of magi liberally against them. Eventually, through war and negotiation, he dominated the other non-talented factions on the island, and handed his successor a tidy, unified, and well-run little kingdom. He is also, hagiographically speaking, credited with receiving from Irinisha, goddess of magic and science, the three great gifts of Perwyn. The first was the periodic table of the lesser elements, the Parada, in old Perwynese. The second was the 20 principles of magic and the physical world, the Perinsi. And the third was the basic symbolic system for shaping and channeling magic, which are still in use to this very day, the Padu, for those taking notes. What exactly he did with these gifts is still debated in the rarefied chambers of academia and religion, but whatever he did, the man got results. For almost 1,000 years, human civilization flourished on Perwyn. Dynasties of Arch-Magi ruled, often benevolently, over the island and its associated mainland colonies. Masters of politics and diplomacy as much as magic, they ruled by guile and wit, shrewdness and calculation. They ruled with the backing of the Dabursi guards, the elite war magi who were the Archmage's personal army. They ruled by maintaining control of the sea lanes against the pirates of Faris, who were troublesome even when they were a loyal province of the Majocracy, the corsairs of Cormyr, who didn't much like the old Majocracy, and the navies and leviathans of the non-human seafolk, who had little enough use for humans at all, transgressing in their sea lanes. But mostly they ruled because of magic. Using Irionite, few non-magical forces could stand up to the Arch Magi. Where did he get it, or the knowledge of its use, when humanity had no previous understanding of the art? The most accepted historical theory implicates his alleged involvement and research with the treefolk of the continent. That ancient race had contact with the coastal colonies that later grew up to become the Greater Majocracy, and then the Five Duchies. It is said that they even helped establish humans on the continent, lending their expertise with plants and soil to us to make the land a viable home. The first Archmage was said to have been shipwrecked near one of their settlements in his youth. Some stories say he stole the first 9 witch stones from them. Others say that they were given to him. Either way, the first Archmage of Perwin, Cordan I, reigned and ruled with those most potent of artifacts in his hand. Later he placed all 9 in the Emerald Staff of the Arch Magi, and that just made him and his successors more powerful. The 9 stones of the staff weren't the only witch stones to be used by the Majocracy. Over time, new stones were discovered or obtained by other means by prominent families of magi, but compared to the powerful array of them in the staff, even these wonders were relatively powerless. The staff could do all sorts of wondrous things, such as raising or quelling storms, useful for controlling the sea lanes, and laying waste to enemies with bolts of black fire, handy for quelling the occasional rebellion or coup attempt. It was said to have had a voice of its own, and was free in offering wise advice to the reigning Archmage. In some cases, the legends and histories hint that the staff itself played an active role in the scheming politics of Perwin. The power was put to the test many times, including the construction of the Twin Towers of Nomawi, the creation of the Spire of Perwin, changing the course of the River Ilnoi, and the reclamation of the San Princo Bay from the sea, some 3 centuries after the first Archmage died in office. That last one was notable because of both its scope, which was godlike, and its failure, which was catastrophic. For 4 short years, Kefan the Damned, the 32nd Archmage of Perwin, basked in the glory of his greatest magical achievement, growing the island's limited arable land by almost a third. Unfortunately, something went wrong, and eventually nearly the whole island plunged back into the depths, leaving only a tiny archipelago of mountaintops to mark the site of the great civilization. After the inundation, the Spire of Perwin, an ancient grey tower that had been built on the highest point of the island, was the only remaining sign that a civilization ever existed there. When the survivors regrouped on the mainland, the staff had been recovered, and the first Archmage of the later, or greater depending upon your view of history, Majocracy, began the long slow process of unifying the coastal colonies and rebuilding them into a shadow of Perwin's lost glory. Irionite became the means by which the barbarian hordes, my ancestors, were held back. Irate non-humans and rebelling peasants were kept in line, and politics were dominated. The palace of the Arch Magi was built in Remes using Irionite. It was also the means by which the first of the Mage Wars were fought. If the old Arch Magi of Perwin had used the stones to unite an empire, they were used by the Mage Lords of the later Majocracy to nearly tear one apart. Noble houses of Magi had conserved their own stones and taken advantage of the loss of Perwin to build their own bases of power. A score of feuding houses, descendants of Perwin's displaced nobility, spent 200 years or so laying waste each other's holdings in an attempt to grab power from whomever was perceived to have had it. For a time, the stones were plentiful, it seemed, and nearly every mage of any significance had one. Factions allied against other factions, while entire villages were destroyed in the orgy of bloodshed. Great magical weapons of devious and deadly design were used to wipe out whole districts. It was a dark time in history. Broken only once the sitting Archmage, an impotent snot of a mage lord named Sinfonir, quit sitting on his hands and began using the staff the way it was supposed to be used. He finally put together enough of a coalition to defeat his opponents, then brought his allies to heel. He made all Eirianites the property of the Imperial House, and had it collected from friend and foe alike, in an act of great charity, according to the official historians, or of great desperation, according to his critics. He had the bulk of it taken to sea and dropped ceremoniously into the depths where Perwin once lay. That made him enormously popular with the common people, who were tired of magical death descending upon them without notice, and extremely unpopular with the nobility, who were almost powerless beside the strength of the staff. But it did bring peace and centralized authority to the land. 400 years later, that peace and stability was abruptly overthrown by the invasion of the Empire by my ancestors, vicious horseback barbarians from the steppes of the north. Our priests were no match for the Imperial War Magi, but we had a huge army, inspired leadership, and faced inept military commanders and a relatively weak Imperial army. Too late did the Archmagi realize their folly, and the last few did their damnedest to defend their tattered empire. The remaining stones on the Emerald Staff were cannibalized to create Androbus, the great sword of the Empire, a last-ditch attempt to save magocracy. It failed, by the way. The sword was lost when the Imperial capital was taken by King Kamaklavan and his 5 sons. The brutal oppression of the Imperial nobility and all things magical began almost immediately after the creation of the 5 duchies. King Kamaklavan's attempt to divide his realm to his heirs equally. He instituted the bans of magic to control the arcane forces, founded the Royal Censorate of Magic to oversee the conquered mage lords of the Empire, and nearly oversaw them out of existence. The empty staff still sits today in the old palace at Remis, guarded by the monks who live there now, a gilded and bejeweled and utterly impotent relic of more powerful days. Since then there has been no Eirianite to speak of in the 5 duchies. Few modern magi have heard more than legends about it. Those who have dared to use it are quickly destroyed by the ruthless war magi of the Censorate. Much of the lore about it was lost during the invasion. While it is rumored that some of the old Imperial families managed to preserve some within their secret cabals, the Green Amber itself was nearly mythical until a decade ago, when the mad mage of Faris used a tiny chunk of it to start sinking ducal warships and upsetting the lives of thousands of ducal citizens, myself included, in a nasty little war. Now a goblin shaman had gotten a hold of a witch stone more than twice as large as the Farisian fragment. The Gurvani didn't have all of the noble and idealistic restraints on its use that the Magocracy, or Faris, had, and even less reason to like us after the Goblin Wars. If there were more stones like this from where the shaman came from, there would be more trouble. A lot more. Trouble we were not prepared to handle. I tried to explain what I had found to Sire Kusi and Sir Kay as well as I could, but the understanding a country knight of the Wilderlands has for such esoteric matters is minimal. Kusi looked thoughtfully at the stone, while Sir Kay prepared to dispatch scouts into the mountains, searching for any more signs of Gurvani activity. Very carefully, I reached down and scooped up the stone in a cloth. What little is known about the stones suggests that they have a kind of sentience of their own, or at least a magical connection with their wielder. It seemed imprudent to allow my bare skin to contact it. I carefully wrapped it and tucked it into a pouch on my belt. Kusi looked confused and disturbed, as he should have been. "What is such a potent implement doing in the hand of a goblin witch-doctor? Surely those beasts don't know its power." I shook my head. "My lord, the Gurvani have inhabited these hills long before our ancestors came here, and it is said that the reason that the duchies, and the empire before them, have produced so many magi, while other lands have but few, is that the forests and mountains where these creatures live have some magical essence that flows downstream with the rivers, and thus invigorates the natural talents of our people. I grew up on the riverbank myself, though there didn't seem to be anything particularly special about it. Yet despite all his power, you slew this one without too much difficulty. He said it as if it settled the matter. No, my lord, I slew him because I took him by surprise, and he was not expecting a trained war mage to attack him, only helpless villagers running in fear. Had I been a second later, or even a little less aggressive, he could have erased this village from this valley like a child stomping on an anthill. Sire Kusi looked down at the shaman's corpse with new respect, and not a little fear. He sighed heavily.
I feared that the goblins had been stirred up. There have been signs. It happens every few decades or so. Usually a few raids are sufficient to convince them to keep within their holes and away from our frontiers. I never heard of them attacking in this strength, nor this deep into our country. What is your advice, Master Minelan?
Asked Sire Kusi calmly, as if we were discussing the cattle over a beer in the market. I would like to think that this is a mere raid for food or treasure, but the evidence here doesn't support that, I said. This looks more like a war party scouting our defences, not a chicken-stealing adventure. It is unlikely that this was an isolated event, as much as I would like it to be so. My lord, if the Garvani are on the move, and they have more of these witchstones, then all of your people are in peril. I would look strongly to their defence. That settled the matter in the lord's mind.
Sakay,
the old knight snapped. My lord,
prepare the castle for siege. Send word to my brother to do likewise at Brandmont, and dispatch riders to the towers to make ready. Summon the militia to service, and break out the armory for immediate drill. Have sentries posted at each village, and send a message to the lords of Prisan and Gans, informing them of the situation. They will send word to Count Raymoth and the Duke.
Aye, my lord. And just like that, we were at war.
Minelan, I am going to ask you to investigate this matter on your own. You seem to know what you are doing,
he added, with restrained confidence. I couldn't disagree, except for the part about me knowing what I was doing.
Yes, sire, I shall begin at once.
I shall take the stone back to my laboratory for further study. Perhaps some answers may be gleaned from it. And under the circumstances, I feel a trip to the north of the valley would be wise.
Kusi looked startled. You mean to involve the tree folk?
The tree folk are involved only in what they want to be, my lord. I reminded him, I merely wish to put a few questions to them and take advantage of their wisdom, if they allow. Their long acquaintance with the area might prove useful.
As you wish,
the knight said slowly, scratching his bald pate.
Though I don't know what kind of help they can provide.
The dismissive and somewhat wary tone intrigued me. The Lord of Beauval Vale largely ignored the colony of non-humans in his domain. They weren't in the habit of paying tribute, after all.
Something. Perhaps some clue.
They are wise and have long haunted these vales. If they will treat with me, they may shed some light on this. I dearly hope so. Or we are likely all doomed. Chapter 3 The Shard of Irionite. The use of Irionite shall be limited in the extreme. No unqualified mage shall seek to explore the mysteries of this most potent of devices, save that they are fully trained and qualified by the censorate to do so. Improper use of Irionite shall impose the harshest of penalties upon the transgressor. The Bands of Magic. I sat, and I stared at the little green stone like it might bite me. It didn't. It persisted in lying there on the little pillow of silk and pretending that it was just an innocent, pretty little piece of harmless rock. I knew better. I took a deep breath and let it out. Irionite. The Stone of Fable. It is at once the most dangerous and most useful substance in the world. It is said to be rarer than diamonds, more precious than gold, more powerful than any known magical component. It had been mentioned in universally reverent tones by my instructors at the academy. My own experience with the stuff was less than helpful. All I can remember about Irianite was that miserably stormy night in Faris, when my unit raided the palace of the Doge, fighting against his professional army and his sorceress lackeys. I still wake up screaming, dreaming about that night. Oril Prak, the mad mage of Faris, had used a piece of Irianite in crafting the deadliest magical weapon since the Magocracy, and he wasn't prepared to come quietly. He hurled bolts of death at us that blew holes in the streets and started raging fire so hot that they burned the masonry. He made the heads of my squadmates explode and sent huge chunks of ruined city flying out to smash our siege engines. Had it not been for superior planning, pure desperation, and more luck than we were probably entitled to, it's quite possible that that little green chip of stone would have defeated us. The one in front of me was twice its reputed size. It had been taken from the hand of a simple goblin shaman. I stared at that damn stone for hours before I got up enough courage to probe its arcane depths. I'd done what research I could first, of course. I am a thaumaturge, among other things, after all. I knew the basics of the study of the science of magic. So I approached my investigation like a school project. It hadn't taken me long to exhaust my tiny library for references on the subject. I had learned a little more than I thought I would, which only made me more afraid of what we were facing. Jarek's Metaphysical Reality had a small listing for Irianite, and said it originated in the loamy meadows of mountain valleys of the Minden Range, where I was standing, although it was often found more rarely in the Kulines. Apart from a few minor pieces of folklore and obvious lies, the Sage of Sherbrooke had little else to say on the matter. Koval's Talismans and Sigils had a more complete listing, and included an account from an even earlier epoch that declared that the Magocracy had stolen its powers from the Guvrani and the Treefolk when they came to this land. Koval made some astute speculation that the powers that they stole were in the form of Irianite gems, and mentioned a few lost and obscure references that I wasn't familiar with to support his claim. Lister's Magical Miscellany described a little of the stone's use in the Magocracy, including some theories about their origin. This last entry was by far the most helpful, and the most frightening. Lister wrote of several accounts of the stones being used for phenomenal feats of magic, including the destruction of whole towns, freezing of rivers in the middle of summer, animating armies of the dead, that sort of thing. Lister's theory about the origin of the stones was interesting and made a great deal of sense. Irianite was not a mineral, he contended. It was an organic substance. He theorized that it was a type of amber, possibly from the sap of the Kelisarth tree. Kelisarth, as Lister explained, is an evergreen shrub whose berries are rich in a substance that was named Kelan by the sages of antiquity. Kelan has the effect of temporarily increasing the expression of potential magic talent in a mage, which is why a distillation of the berry is sometimes used in the early days of an apprentice's training, if he is having a hard time producing power. Sometimes the distilled essence will allow the pathways used for magical work to open up more fully and less painfully than if left to develop on their own. It has been used to varying degrees of success to treat a few of the rare magical ailments that our profession is hazard to. The book also mentioned that some mountain peasants eat the raw berries before orgiastic fertility rituals, as it increases their awareness. That last one I doubted. I had been in the mountains for over 6 months now, and if someone was having orgiastic fertility rituals, they had failed to invite me. Prolonged use, however, can be addictive and toxic, causing madness, gradual degeneration of nerve control, and eventual death. That part wasn't in dispute. There is even a fringe element of my profession that perpetually seeks to discover a way that Kellan can be used safely. They haven't had much luck, and you can find the poor, palsied bastards hanging around the academies sometimes, begging their wiser colleagues for money for more research. Kelisarth was not uncommon in the lowlands, where it often made a fragrant and decorative shrub around manor houses and old imperial buildings. When found there, it usually isn't potent enough to produce Kelan in any quantity. and while it is a bit sappy, I couldn't imagine a single bush producing enough sap to solidify the kind of volume I assumed it would take to form a witch stone. Botany is not my strong suit, but the Kalasarth shrubs I had grown up around simply don't get that big. However, in the few months I had been in the mountains, I had noticed that the Kalasarth grew much larger and more robustly at this altitude. Until now it had merely been a curious footnote of botanical lore for the book I would someday write in my dotage. If those more robust Kalasarth trees produced a significant amount of sap, then it was only logical that the magical properties of the plant were present in stronger quantities, enough to produce a kind of amber, perhaps, over a few centuries. It also explained why the rivers that were spawned from these hills produced a bumper crop of magi in the valleys below. Particles of Irionite ore on Kalasarth sap would have washed away into creeks and streams with the rain. Water runs downhill. People drink water. Therefore, Kalasarth particles became infused in the tissues of future magi. Like me. It was a compelling theory. The Gravani had inhabited these mountains far longer than humans, and they must have come into contact with both the tree and the rock, I reasoned, the same way that we had. Despite prejudices to the contrary, the average Gurvan is not any more or less stupid than your average human peasant. In fact, from what the lore masters at the academy taught